We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good to have you both here. We did start last week with talking about the election.
Yes. Coming up on November 8th, get your ballots in early, preferably to drop boxes. We sent a check to somebody in California and at the beginning of this month, and it took 2 weeks to get there. So, you know, just remember that Trump destroyed the Postal Service and it's not particularly reliable anymore. Drop boxes are much more secure, and King County Elections has them all over the county. They have the list at the website. It's highly recommended you use them.
Yeah, it, you can register to vote online through this coming Monday, October 31st. And to do that, you go to www.sos for Secretary of State, .wa.gov/elections. And there's a green button at the top right to register to vote.
Yeah. And you can also change your registration if you've moved, for example, get your ballot that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you'll also be able to register in person. The easiest place is here in Seattle at Lumen Field, at the Lumen Field Visitors Center, which is going to be open for voter registration on 3 days just before the election on Saturday, November 5th from 10 a.m. to 4, Monday, November 7th from 8:30 to 6, and on election day itself from 8:30 to 8 p.m.
And for the three of our listeners who are also football fans, the NFL is doing that at every stadium in every city it's in. So that's coordinated with the Seahawks and they're doing that in every city. So, props to them.
Lots of ways to register to vote. And this is a great time to do it if you haven't.
Yeah. And there really are a lot of races that are important this year. Maria went over most of the ballot candidates races last week, so I'm not going to do that this week. What I'm going to do is something that I have not done in the 27 years or so that we've been covering elections, which is to say that people should, in my opinion, make a blanket vote for any Democrat in any race where there's a Republican on the ballot. The Republican Party for the state of Washington is every bit as bad and every bit as crazy as, you know, all of the depredations that you hear Republican candidates and Republican party nominees making in less liberal parts of the country. And I fully expect that if Republicans lose some of these statewide races, they're not going to concede. They're going to claim voter fraud. Just like what's his name did in the gubernatorial race in 2020. We've got election deniers at the top of the Republican ticket in Tiffany Smiley, the Republican candidate against Patty Murray for senator. If you've seen her TV ads, she does not identify that she is a Republican, let alone what her policy preferences are, because if she talked about them, she would get, you know, lapped off the ballot. She believes, for instance, in banning all abortions, no exceptions, for rape or incest. And she just goes down the Republican Party line like that. She is very, very extreme. And she's trying her best to hide that. I've been pretty critical of Patty Murray over the 30 years that she's been in Washington, D.C., but in this case, there's no contest because she is reality-based, and Tiffany Smiley, who is a 2020 election denier, just like most of the other Republicans running in this state, is not. She's just not tethered to reality, or at least she's encouraging her followers not be tethered to reality. She probably knows it's BS, but she's certainly not going to say that.
One of the things that bothers me a lot about that race is the polling in that race shows that a majority of women voters support Patty Murray, and a majority of male voters support Tiffany Smiley. Smiley fits very firmly in the mold of young, blonde, and very, very pretty, but not substantive in experience or on the issues. So that just kind of really irks me, the fact that she's this cosmetic candidate that appeals to male voters.
If she does well in this race, yeah, but doesn't necessarily win, she's got a job waiting for her at Fox News. She fits their template.
Pretty much the template that she, the mold that she was kind of fits right into.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, the fact that she won the Republican primary probably has a lot to do with that Fox News template for the last 30 years, mm-hmm. you know, because we've just been assaulted with young, attractive, stupid blonde after young, attractive, stupid blonde. It's their, it's in their performance catalog, basically. So, yeah, that's a very disturbing race. And, polling shows that Murray is comfortably ahead of Tiffany Smiley. If Smiley actually wins that race, we've got a lot more problems nationally than I want to contemplate. But,
one of the interesting things about that race is the money in that race. Murray has raised about $17,885.51 as of yesterday, while Smiley has raised $16,519,954. So they're pretty close to each other in terms of funding. Patty Murray's received a lot of money from the usual Democratic campaign sources, including the Democratic campaign committees, a lot of labor unions, a lot of tech companies, defense contractors, medical and insurance companies, a lot of business consulting groups, all the usual companies that support a lot of the national Democratic candidates. Smiley, when you look at her funders, she has, in terms of companies, you don't see very many company names except for Koch Industries. And then she's got a ton of conservative PACs with names like, you know, the Heartland Values PAC, Champion American Values PAC.
Oh, Heartland Values PAC is a nasty piece of work.
Yeah, they all are. Let's get
to
work.
They have history.
Yeah.
You know, and some of these things are just assembled out of thin air.
But, yeah. And
but Heartland goes back a number of years.
Yeah. And then the URA Political Action Committee, and really unsurprisingly, the Associated Builders and Contractors PAC. So you really get a pretty good idea that corporations are not comfortable with directly donating to a Republican candidate as extreme as Tiffany Smiley. So they're funding her through a ton of these little PACs, some of them assembled on the fly. Many of them are PACs that were originally set up to support other candidates in Midwest races, and have been expanded to fund races in other states. So like the Heartland Values PAC, I think, is John Thune's, originally his PAC, and it has expanded to support candidates in other states as well.
And it originated as a PAC to support anti-abortion candidates also.
Yes. Uh-huh. So she's obviously running on that platform, but she's not obvious about it when she debates or talks about her positions. So I think it's very interesting that there's probably a lot of corporate money behind Smiley, but that corporate money is hiding by donating in these PACs so that it's not transparent to the voters.
Yeah.
So.
And speaking of Republicans who aren't necessarily what they seem, let's talk about Joe Kent in the 3rd congressional district race. He was the MAGA Trump endorsed candidate who beat the incumbent, Jamie Herrera Rivera in the primary. And, it now has an excellent chance of losing that seat to a Democrat. that makes it a really important race because it might help offset some of the losses of Democrats nationally that are expected in the House. And if the Democrats have any hope of keeping control of the House, it will be because of their ability to flip seats like the third. Joe Kent, there was some questions that were raised this week about who's supporting Joe Kent, not who's supporting his campaign, but who's supporting him personally, because he has been enlisting his employer for months as something something called what was it? It was something, American Enterprise Solutions. It's kind of a bland name. You have no idea what that means. And it was allegedly a consulting company based in Reston, Virginia. Well, nothing in the Commonwealth of Virginia by that name exists. And some enterprising reporters went digging and found that nothing with anything close to that name in the state of Virginia exists.
Which is not hard to look up that information. Most states have a website where you look up business registrations, and if it's not listed there, it's not an active business in the state.
No, you can look it up if from, say, your newsroom cubicle in Vancouver.
Yeah, I could look it up online.
Sure, so could I. And, you know, so Kent is claiming now that, oh, he got the name all wrong.
of his employer.
Yeah. Now, how
that's
many
grounds
people,
for firing?
How many people, you know, routinely screw up the name of our employer? But he's making a six-figure income allegedly from this employer, and it raises the question of who exactly that is. And hasn't been forthcoming on this, and I really hope it's going to hurt him because he is nuts. To put it politely, again, he's Trump endorsed. He's fully on the Trump bandwagon of the stolen 2020 election, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there are enough people who have moved to Vancouver and Clark County, particularly from Portland in the last couple of years, that I think there's a strong chance that Democrats can flip that seat. We'll find out in a couple of weeks.
The candidate there, Democrat Marie Glusenkamp-Perez, is a very, very good candidate. It will be good to see if she can take that district seat away from the Republicans. There were a couple of races that I didn't get to last week, two judgeships in the Seattle Municipal Court that are contested. And I wanted to talk about who I think the better candidate is in those two races. The first one is position 3 on the Seattle Municipal Court. It has incumbent Adam Eisenberg running against challenger Pooja Vahdati. Vahdati has some really good policy positions that I really like. And Eisenberg was one of the Seattle Municipal Court judges who has been very, very supportive of City Attorney Ann Davison's campaign to prosecute every single misdemeanor that comes her way, which I think shows you his leaning is more conservative. I think Vahdati would be a really good choice in that race in terms of the progressive direction that the city's trying to go in to divert as many folks who are charged with a misdemeanor as possible from actually just jailing.
Yeah, and that is not only better for the defendants, but it also saves the city a ton of money.
Yeah. And then in position 9, which is the other contested court position, incumbent Judge Damon Shadid is running with a challenger in Assistant City Attorney Nijet Rose Akins. Rose Akins was also a huge supporter of City Attorney Ann Davison. And is very, very critical of the community court and the other diversion programs at the Seattle Municipal Court. Judge Damon Shadid is one of the folks who he runs the community court and oversees the other. I think there are two other diversion courts there. I think Shadid should be reelected as the incumbent in that position.
That's a more progressive
pick.
That race really interests me because I think it's a nice snapshot of how Republicans have very quietly or, you know, ideologically aligned people aligned with Republicans have been very quietly backing, candidates for some of these yeah. down ballot races that most people don't pay attention to. School board races, and we've heard a lot about, but also courtships. Republicans have been very smart about trying to pack the courts at the federal level, and they're trying to do it at the local level as well. So, the incumbent is Shadid is much better.
Yeah. So Vadadi in position 3 and Shadid in position 9, incumbent Damon Shadid in position 9. Hopefully I didn't mangle his name too much.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about who's you mentioned
campaign financing. I spent quite a bit of time this week looking at the campaign financing in the races where we had two Democrats running, and it wasn't really clear about which Democrat would be the better pick. So I started out with Secretary of State's position, where you have incumbent Democrat Steve Hobbs versus a nonpartisan challenger, Julie Anderson. And I said last week that it looked like a lot of the folks who endorsed Anderson were Democrats. So I went and looked at how much they'd raised. Anderson has raised $343,756 versus Steve Hobbs, $780,570, which is more than double Anderson's total. Hobbs has $92,100 from political action committees. That's just under 12% of his total, which is actually quite low given some of these other candidates I'm going to talk about, versus Anderson's $8,700, which is only about 2.5% of her total. Again, quite low. Anderson's largest contributors are primarily individuals, and when they list an employer, many of them are in the real estate development, financial, and venture capital industries. But almost two-thirds of her donors are folks who gave $100 or less to her campaign, which is notable. So there's that kind of mixed message there when you look at her contributors. Hobbs' contributions look very, very different. Like a lot of the big Democratic candidates in these large statewide or national races, his largest contributors are the Washington State Democratic Party and the House Democratic Campaign Committee. He's also hosted some very large fundraising parties to rub elbows with and raise cash from corporations and wealthy Democratic Party donors. He also has a lot of union support. He has contributions from a wide range of businesses in many, many different industries and lots of individual contributions. About 55% of his contributions, though, are over $100 and 45% are $100 or less. So a real mix there, but the kind of the standard thing you find when you look at a statewide or a national Democratic candidate. So very much within the mold of the Democratic Party. Anderson, mixed message, and it's really hard to tell if that means she's going to be responsive to these more conservative, corporations that donated and individuals who donated to her who work in the real estate development, financial and venture capital industries. Okay. So if you're still trying to decide between the two of them, that's something you can take into account. I think last week I gave a slight leaning towards Steve Hobbs, with my criteria always being, if the incumbent's doing a good job, why replace them? Okay. And I think Steve Hobbs is doing a pretty good job.
And I agree with that totally.
Yeah. Now, in the race for state senator in District 32, that's Northwest Seattle, Shoreline, and Edmonds, incumbent Jesse Salomon is running with a challenger, Patricia Weber. Salomon has $171,394 in contributions versus Weber's $18,673. So Salomon has way outraised Weber to an almost ridiculous degree. Almost a third of Salomon's total is from PAC money. And some of those PACs include the Washington State Auto Dealers, the Washington Rental Owners Association PAC, Washington Business Properties Association PAC, Rental Housing Association PAC, Washington Healthcare Association PAC, Washington Beer and Wine Distributors Association, the Insurance and Financial Advisors PAC, the
Washington. I'm seeing a theme here.
Yeah, the Cattle PAC, the Washington Association.
Wait, cattle PAC. Can vote?
Well, they're trying
yeah,
to.
Yeah, and the you know Washington.
Don't they drool on the ballots?
Yes, they do. And it just goes on and on like that. About 20% of his contributions come directly from businesses, including businesses like Pfizer Inc., Home Depot, Delta Dental of Washington, Bristol-Myers Squibb, Walgreens, PEMCO Insurance, Microsoft, Agribeef Management, Amazon.com, and Goodman wow. Real Estate. He also has several unions, including healthcare unions supporting him. Notably, 69% of his donations are at the maximum of $1,000, and that's the highest percentage of any candidate running for the state legislature on this list. So.
Wow. He owes a lot of favors.
Yes. He owes a lot of debts there. To those folks. Now, Salomon vice chairs the Senate Agriculture, Water, Natural Resources, and Parks Committee. So that's why the cattle pack is in there and, big agribusiness is trying to influence him. He also sits on the Housing and Local Government and the Law and Justice Committee. So that again is why you see the real estate lobby in there and you see the, medical lobby in there. The Senate Natural Resources Committee and the Housing Committee are expected to play really big roles in the upcoming rewrite of the state's comprehensive plan. So that's why he's garnered all this attention from these folks. Now, Patricia Weber's contributions look very, very different. Two-thirds of her contributions are from folks who gave $100 or less. That's a pretty high percentage for any of the candidates on this list. Of the larger contributions, most of them are from her own pocket. Now, her donors are mostly women who live in her district. Okay. She has only one PAC contribution, $250 from the Washington State National Organization for Women's PAC. Okay. And that might make you say, hey, well, you know, she's a special interest candidate. But then I would have to point out that women demographically make up just over 50% of the residents of her district. And because she's strong on education and school issues, if you add in the interests of children and parents, both male and female, she represents a pretty solid majority in District 32. So
I'm always amused when I hear women's issues, quote unquote, which are not necessarily women's issues.
Is a minority issue, right?
Men have a responsibility too, but it's described as a special interest.
I know. Yeah. So if you were still trying to decide in that race, I hope that information helped you out.
Yeah.
Now, and I have to say, I think last week I said Salomon looked like the better candidate, but I think after looking at their campaign contributions, I've changed my mind in that race.
Strongly,
I think Weber
strongly disagree
is,
with that.
Is the more progressive candidate there.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah. You can be thankful I wasn't here last week because I would have argued with you.
Yeah. Now, in the other races I'm going to talk about, there's one other where looking at the campaign contributions, may have changed my mind as well, but for most of them, it actually confirmed how I felt about these candidates. So let me move on. Here, state representative for District 34, position one, that's West Seattle and Vashon Island, Emily Alvarado is running versus Leah Griffin. Both are Democrats, and they're running neck and neck in this race.
Yeah, that's a hard race.
Yeah, in terms of financing, because they both look like really great candidates, right? But I think when you start looking at the contributions, then things kind of fall out in an interesting way. In terms of financing, Alvarado has raised $146,876 versus Griffin's $119,000. Alvarado has collected $14,400 from PACs. That's just under 10% of her total. And Griffin has $4,500 from PACs. That's under 4% of her total. Alvarado's PACs, however, include Real Justice Washington PAC, Justice for All PAC, the Washington State Building and Construction Trades PAC, the Washington Education Association PAC, and the Retired Public Employees Council of Washington. She also has a lot of contributions from unions, liberal attorneys, local Democratic politicians, several, and this is key, several low-income housing organizations and nonprofits and the folks who run them, and lots of individual donors. Griffin has the support of the Justice for All PAC, the National Women's Political Caucus, the Washington State Federation of Democratic Women, the Washington Food Industry Association PAC, and a lot of individual donors. Not many businesses are supporting either candidate, which makes this race, I think, a lot harder to decide just based on the money. But I think it's really, really important to note that Alvarado has the support of a lot of low-income housing folks and a lot of community organizers who are working on those issues of trying to house the homeless. So in that sense, I feel like Alvarado is much more closely connected to the progressive community than Griffin, even though they both look like really good candidates. Now, for state representative, District 36, Position 1, that's my district, Queen Anne Magnolia, Northwest Seattle. Julia Reed is running versus Jeff Manson. Reed has raised $195,000 versus Manson's about $101,000. Reed has $12,700 from PACs. That's about 6.5% of her total. And Manson has $750. That's less than 1%. Okay. So he wasn't out there raising money from PACs. That's kind of interesting. Manson has also contributed $6,555 of his own money to his campaign. Reed's PAC money includes, a PACE PAC, which supports Asian and Pacific Islander candidates, Washington Healthcare Association, the Washington Physical Therapy PAC, the Washington Beer and Wine Distributors, the Washington State Auto Dealer Association, Real Justice Washington PAC, Washington Refuse and Recycling Association, the Washington Food Industry Association, and the Stand Up for Children Washington PAC, and this is interesting, the NewCorp Political Action Committee of Washington. So a real mixed bag there.
That's a wild mix.
Of a wild mix. Businesses that support Reed include the BNSF Railway Company, Pemco Insurance, Delta Dental of Washington. The individuals who've contributed to Reed's campaign include Zach Silk, who is president of Civic Ventures. That's Adrian Hanauer's organization. And interestingly, on the other side, the slumlord Carl Hagland. Okay. So again, a real weird mix. She also has the support of several labor unions. Now, Manson's PAC money comes primarily from one source, the Halibut and Sablefish Sustainable Fisheries PAC. He's also supported by the Children's Campaign Fund. Companies that support him include Feliz Como Vida LLC, which is a New York business, has a New York business registration but no website, PSI Urethanes, Inc., which appears to be run by a George Manson, probably Jeff Manson's relative, and Infinity Squared Media LLC, run by a Mark Manson, possibly also his relative. Also a handful of unions and lots of individual contributors, including King County Council member Gene Cole Wells and former state rep Mary Lou Dickerson. Okay, so in this race, I recommended Julia Reed as the more progressive candidate. But after looking at their campaign contributions, for Reed to garner the kinds of the variety of contributions that she has from both the left and right makes me wonder if she's been really solid on supporting left-wing policy.
Proposal. And I would point out also that Pemco Insurance, which is one of her corporate donors, has a long history of supporting right-wing candidates. I was kind of surprised to hear them on that list. I also wonder if the Halibut PAC is related to the Cattle PAC, but that's just
no, I don't think so. So in this race, I am inclined to lean towards Jeff Manson after looking at the list of donations.
Yeah, I was very, very torn on that race, but I came down on the side of Manson also.
Mm-hmm. So after recommending Reed, now after looking at the contributions, I'm kind of leaning towards Manson. So I hope that helps you out in making a decision. Now, for state representative District 37, position 2, that again, another tough race where you have two really great candidates, Chipolo Street and Imijah Smith. Street has raised $141,595 versus Smith's $125,000. So there's not a huge gap between the two candidates, fundraising wise. In PAC money.
That's my district, by the way.
Yeah, in PAC money, Street has $6,750, just under 5% of his total, and Smith has $4,700, just under 4%. So again, pretty comparable there. Street's biggest PAC contributors, however, include the Washington Healthcare Association, Washington State Dental PAC, Washington Beverage Association, the Washington Hospitality Association PAC, the Justice for All PAC, the Washington Multifamily Housing Association, and the Washington Food Industry Association. Street's largest contributors work mostly in high-tech companies like Microsoft, Amazon, Google, Meta, Oracle, Smartsheet, Code Academy, and Pinterest.
Yeah, that's not a surprise because that is his background.
Yeah, Street himself has worked at Microsoft, and you can see a ton of Microsoft employees who've donated to his campaign. Street has also donated $4,616 of his own money. Notably, Street has the second highest percentage of donors who've given the maximum of $1,000, almost 51% of his contributors versus 35% for Smith. Again, Jesse Salomon had the highest. Street has the second highest.
Now, and for context, this is in a district that has the greatest level of poverty of any district in Seattle.
Yeah, of any of the ones we're talking about today. Now, Imijah Smith's main PAC money is from, this looks quite different from Chipolo Street's, is from the UAW, that's the United Auto Workers Region 8 Western States PAC, Pro-Choice Washington, Real Justice Washington, the Win with Women PAC, and the People Power Solutions PAC. So that looks very different from Chipolo Street's funding. She also has large contributions from several labor unions and many smaller contributions from community organizers and individual donors. So that kind of reinforced my feeling that the more progressive candidate in that race is community organizer Imijah Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for State Representative District 46, Position 2, Daria Farivar is running versus Laylock Rave. Rave has raised $308,495 versus Farivar's $168,590, a little over half of her opponent's haul. Rave's PAC money is $15,150, about 5% of her total, and Farivar's is $6,250, under 4% of her total. Farivar has contributed $3,000 of her own money to her campaign. Now, Rave is a doctor and has large contributions from ZoomCare, Washington State Society of Anesthesiologists PAC, Washington Healthcare Association, Washington State Dental PAC, Primera Blue Cross, which is an insurance company, Hospitals for a Healthy Future PAC, United Health Group, Inc., another insurance company, Regents, another insurance company, Physicians Insurance, Washington Medical PAC, and on and on and on. Now, she also has a ton of large contributions from doctors and the employees of medical and insurance companies. She also has large contributions from individuals who work in the real estate, finance, and investment banking sectors. And over 40% of Rave's contributions are the maximum $1,000, and that's the third highest percentage of the candidates on this list today. So by comparison, about 25% of Farivar's contributions are the maximum of $1,000. And that is actually lower than most candidates on this list who average around 30 to 35%. Her largest PAC contributions are from the Washington Housing Alliance Action Fund, the UAW Region 8 Western States PAC, that's the United Auto Workers, Real Justice Washington PAC, Justice for All PAC, Pro-Choice Washington, and the Stand for Children Washington PAC. She also has several labor unions supporting her and lots of small individual donors. So again, that reinforced my gut feeling that Daria Farivar is the more progressive candidate in that race.
Yeah, I agree with that too.
So that kind of that's kind of the races where I thought it might be close, or people might be leaning one way or the other on which Democratic candidate to choose. There is one county race I also took a look at, the King County Prosecuting Attorney's race, Lisa Mannion versus Jim Farrell. In this race, which appears to be running pretty close, Farrell has raised $352,000 versus Mannion's $334,000. So they're very close in fundraising. Farrell has $15,900 in PAC money versus Mannion's $500 in PAC money. So another race where Farrell is bringing in more PAC money. And it's interesting to look at who Farrell's biggest contributors are. They include the Retail Action Council, the Washington Association of Realtors, the Seattle Building and Construction Trades Council, and the Washington Business Properties Association. His supporters also include Bruce McCaw, McCaw Cellular, Ike Eisenberg, the conservative owner of Uncle Ike's Pot Shop, John Goodman of Goodman Real Estate, Michael Dunn of Dunn Lumber, the Vance Corporation, which is a commercial real estate company, Clyde's Properties, Martin Seelig, the big real estate developer, the Sabe Corporation, another big real estate developer, Kemper Holdings, and several other individuals who work in real estate, construction, and finance.
And several of the names you mentioned there have long histories of donating to conservative candidates.
To very conservative candidates, yeah. Over 52% of his contributions come from folks who contributed the maximum of $1,000.
Particularly Martin Seelig and Kemper Freeman.
Oh, yeah. Now, Mannion's largest contributions, on the other hand, come from several district and state Democratic Party organizations, labor unions, the Real Justice Washington PAC, the Stand for Children Washington PAC, Civic Action, and Nick Hanauer, who also donated personally, the Alliance for Gun Responsibility, and a lot of individual contributors. More than 52% of her contributors gave $100 or less. So the flip of the absolute flip of Jim Farrell, 52% of his contributors gave the maximum $1,000. 52% of Mannion's contributors gave $100 or less. So I think that draws a pretty clear line there between who the progressive versus who the conservative candidate is in that race.
Yep.
And then I looked at the who's funding the ballot measure here in the city of Seattle, Proposition numbers 1A and 1B. Just a reminder for folks, Prop 1A was an initiative signed by voters, and 1B is the alternative measure that the city council put on the ballot alongside the original 1A. Prop 1A would change Seattle elections to approval voting for mayor, city attorney, and city council members. Voters would be able to vote for as many candidates as they approve of for each office in the primary, and then the two candidates receiving the most votes would go to the final election in November. Prop 1B is the alternative. That's ranked choice voting. In the primary, voters would rank the candidates they prefer by preference, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. In ranked choice voting, all the number one preferences are counted and the candidate with the lowest votes is eliminated. Then folks who voted for that candidate as their number one candidate, their second preference vote would be counted. And then another candidate eliminated and so forth until you're down to two candidates who would go to the final in November. So who's funding which proposition? Let's take a look. For Prop 1A, approval voting, The group Seattle Approves has raised about $643,000. Its largest single donor is the Center for Election Science based in Walnut, California, which advocates for approval voting. It has contributed $312,883, or about half of all the money that they've raised. The next highest contributor is Samuel Bankman Fried of FTX Digital Markets, who lives in the Bahamas and who is a huge supporter
of democracy.
a huge supporter of approval voting. He's contributed $135,000. The third highest contributor is John Hageman of Meta Platforms in Palo Alto, California, who's contributed $55,000. Then we have five more big contributors, three of whom live in California, Eric Rogstad, Jeff Justice, and Scott Siskind, who gave $25,000, $20,000, and $10,000 respectively. Only two of the largest contributors are from Seattle. Troy Davis, who gave $25,000, and Aviel Ginsberg of Founders Co-op, who gave $10,000. A look at the other contributions over $100 shows a lot of tech people from Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and other tech companies, not all of whom are from Seattle. In fact, 90% of the contributions for approval voting are from outside the city of Seattle, and 98% of their contributions are $700 or more. So the word Seattle approves is really not descriptive of the group that's actually supporting Prop 1A. It's more like rich techies who don't live here approve. Now, for Prop 1B, the ranked choice voting alternative, the group Ranked Choice Voting for Seattle has raised $282,762. So well under half of what Seattle Approves has raised. Its largest contributor is also from outside of Seattle. Fair Vote Action is based in Maryland. They've contributed $200,000, which is almost 71% of their total. But of the contributions over $500, most are from people who live inside the city of Seattle or at least in King County on the east side in Kirkland and Issaquah.
What a concept.
Yeah, wow. 77% of their total contributions are from outside the city of Seattle, however. 11% are from people who live in District 7. That's downtown, Belltown, Queen Anne, and Magnolia. And 10% are from District 3, which is Capitol Hill, First Hill, and North Beacon Hill. 96% of their contributions are $700 or more. So again, not a lot more representative of who lives in the city of Seattle, but at least slightly more representative than the rich techies who don't live here approve campaign. And finally, there's a third group, and it's not easy to tell which side they're on or even what they're doing. That group is called Seattle for Election Simplicity, and it has raised about $44,500 from a group of Seattle's leading property owners and real estate developers. Its only activity so far has been to conduct a poll, which hasn't been released to the public. And whether it's a push poll or they were just trying to understand if they should jump in and support one side or the other, I don't know.
I would gather from the name that it's probably an anti-ranked choice.
Yeah. So I'm not quite sure. I have not been part of the poll, so haven't gotten a call or anything. So if any of our listeners have gotten a call about this issue, it'd be interesting to hear from them what kinds of questions they were asked so that we can determine if that was a push poll or
yeah,
not.
Yeah, we've got another week to talk about, campaign finances and push polls and all that kind of
and the election.
Stuff. And then the week after that, we'll be talking about results.
All right, so we've got about 15 minutes to touch on city budget.
Oh, okay. Boy.
Wow. Yeah, no, I have a lot on the city budget.
And anything else that might have happened this week.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I'll try to go through this pretty quickly. So the city council has been spending the last couple of weeks looking at the individual departments of the city budget. They've got some big issues to consider. How to deal with the $141 million shortfall this year and the fact that there are shortfalls projected for 2024, 2025, and 2026 going forward as well. They have some options. One would be to accept Mayor Harrell's proposal to allow the Jumpstart payroll tax funds to be raided year after year after year to plug holes in the general fund. Another option is to reject some of the increases planned for the departments that are set to get increases for 2023 and 24 and also make some further cuts. Or they can work with the Seattle Revenue Stabilization Work Group to come up with new progressive sources of revenue for the city budget. But that is the key overarching issue behind most of the budget talks this year. One of the other big issues is the council is going to be looking at specific programs that Harrell is using the Jumpstart tax, payroll tax funds to pay for, and if those programs really qualify as economic revitalization, homeless services, affordable housing, and Green New Deal programs, the things that the payroll tax is supposed to pay for.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert, yeah, there are quite a few that don't qualify. One example is $200,000 in one-time funding from the Jumpstart Payroll Tax Fund that Harrell wants to use to pay for, quote, an organization such as the Seattle Sports Commission to advance economic development and sports tourism in the city of Seattle, including efforts to support the execution of the 2023 Major League Baseball All-Star Game and future major sporting events such as the 2025 FIFA World Cup. That's the Soccer World Cup.
Some context there. Mm-hmm. There is a significant lobby in the city of Seattle
that really
pines for the days of the kingdom hosting big national sporting events like the Goodwill Games, the Final Four, things like that.
Yes.
And there's been a push for a long time to replace the Ellis brothers as movers and shakers who could make things like that happen. And this is money to advance that agenda.
Yeah, so it's an open question. Does that qualify as economic revitalization, or is that some kind of discretionary entertainment type fund? Plus, the whole program is not
very. It's very temporary, fleeting revitalization. Is
mm-hmm,
what it is.
Yeah, so I think it's a stretch to fit some of Harrell's funding requests into the requirements of the Jumpstart Payroll Tax Fund money. Another issue with Mayor Harrell's budget is that the central staff and several council members think the Seattle Police Department budget undercounts the number of officers who will leave the department through the rest of this year and next year, and may also be undercounting the number of new police recruits that they can hire. So there could be additional savings within the SPD budget. But over the past week or two, the council members have been proposing amendments to the budget, most of which would add funding back that Harrell has cut. Now, on Friday in particular, we saw amendments for things like the Public Safety Human Services and the Seattle Department of Transportation. I just want to give you some of the highlights there. Lisa Herbold proposed an amendment to add $2.6 million to the Community Safety and Communications Center to expand the Community Service Officer Program so that they can take on additional public safety duties, including potentially answering some low-priority 911 calls. That money would also fund a new program for the 911 call center to dispatch a team of trained mental / behavioral health workers alongside police officers for some types of 911 calls. So she's trying to move forward on reassigning some 911 calls there, something that Harrell's budget is not doing. There are two amendments in the SPD budget from Lisa Herbold. One would require the SPD to continue its quarterly reporting to the City Council. The second amendment requests that the SPD make quarterly reports to the Council on their risk management demand project that is evaluating how 911 calls are classified and handled and how to update that system. And then Shama Sawant had a walk-on amendment that proposed to cut the gunshot detection program. And Teresa Mosqueda and Lisa Herbold immediately said, we want to co-sponsor that. So those are the three specific amendments on the SPD budget, but that doesn't mean there won't be further changes to the budget. It means that as they do reconciliation of the budget over the next week, there may be further cuts or further changes to the line of items.
That gunshot detection program mm-hmm. is part of what SPD is using to justify higher patrols, mostly in communities of color in the South End.
Yeah. And there were many amendments.
And that's the argument against it.
Yeah. Those were the three SPD budget amendments. There were many, many amendments to the Human Services Department. The big ones was the big one or two, the first one of note was Teresa Mosqueda's amendment to add $7.1 million to fund a full cost of living wage increase for service providers that would be in line with inflation, 7.6% for 2023, unlike Mayor Harrell's proposed 4% increase, which would have meant a pay cut for these important frontline human service workers. And then Lisa Herbold proposed another amendment that would add $5.6 million to fully fund a cost of living wage increase in 2024, the second year of the two-year budget. So that's the big good news there, is that the council is aware of that pay cut and they're trying to address it. And then also several amendments were proposed by Shama Sawant and by Dan Strauss to provide funding for food programs. COVID-19 relief funds were used over the last 3 years to pay for many food programs that are now losing that funding. The council is trying somehow to make those programs permanent if they can, particularly in light of the fact that inflation is making it hard for families and for elderly folks on a fixed income to afford rising food prices. So that the council's aware of that.
Every time I buy groceries, my jaw drops.
I know.
It's really bad.
Let's see here. Yeah, and Shama Sawant proposed adding $5 million for the purchase of a 72-unit hotel on Aurora Avenue North, the Comfort Inn, to be used as a non-congregate shelter. This is something that Andrew Lewis has proposed in the past that the city council keeps coming back to. Lehigh has a purchase agreement that's all ready to go. They just need the additional funding. With this $5 million from the city, Lehigh could get an additional $18.2 million in state funding to get to do the full purchase and start rehabbing that to use as a homeless shelter. And because it's you know, individual rooms, it's non-congregate, it could be a great place to do enhanced shelter services with wraparound services, which I think is a really, really good idea. Now, Teresa Mosqueda, this is very interesting too. Teresa Mosqueda proposed reducing Mayor Harrell's expansion of the Unified Care Team by 5 full-time staff and sending the $812,000 in savings plus an additional $400,000 to the King County Regional Homelessness Authority for their outreach programs instead. She worked with the King County Regional Homelessness Authority and then got approval from Deputy Mayor Tiffany Washington to pursue changing the whole focus of Harrell's proposed unified care team so that more of the data gathering and guiding people into shelter was being done by the King County Regional Homelessness Authority and their partners. And that they contract with rather than the city taking on a duplicative role. And there was a lot of discussion about that program, but I think what she did was absolutely brilliant. And I hope that it works out and that the mayor's office doesn't simply step back and say, well, that's the city council's program. It's not up to snuff. We're going to do our own thing again.
Yeah. And remember the whole rationale behind the county homelessness authority was to take those kind of programs off the city's plate and make them, you know, more coordinated regional effort. So, you know, Harrell proposing his teams really flies in the face of that.
Yeah. So those were kind of the major highlights. You know, Lisa Herbold also proposed adding additional money for LEAD and co-LEAD to get them closer to their full capacity. And that was a little controversial. There are still some members of the city council who don't understand what LEAD and co-LEAD do. I'm thinking particularly Sarah Nelson and Deborah Juarez, who are not huge fans of it. But the majority of the city council supports that. And hopefully that will also pass. And there are many, many other amendments, particularly in the Department of Transportation budget, that were interesting, but we don't really have time to talk about them today.
I haven't had a chance to look. Is there an amendment that would increase the funding of the city funding for the Regional Homelessness Authority? Because Harrell's budget really undercut the amount of funding that they had asked for from the city.
I think that's, Tammy Morales proposed restoring a portion, about $9.4 million of the COVID-19 relief funds that the King County Regional Homelessness Authority is set to lose at the end of this year. That's not going to cover it all, but it is going to cover some really important shelter, rapid rehousing, diversion, and outreach programs that the Homelessness Authority is doing. So the council is also aware of that, and they're trying to address it. But they're also concerned because they want other regional partners to step up. So not just the city of Seattle funding all this with the King County Regional Homelessness Authority, but the government of King County itself and the other city governments need to start stepping up and funding some of it too. Mm-hmm. So that's the wrap up for this week. Next week, the council will get an updated revenue forecast. That's going to be released at noon on November 2nd. So that may either make the council's job easier or harder to balance the budget, because they're going to have to go back and say, okay, we want to add some stuff back, but that means we're going to have to make some cuts or we're going to have to find new revenue sources. That's coming next week when they reconcile and produce the balancing package.
Just a few minutes left. Jobs, you want to talk about the COVID updates for this week?
Yeah, there's been some COVID news since the last time I was on this show. We are now down to under 200 new infections a day in King County. That's very good news. It may not last since the weather is turning cooler and rainier this past week. And we have Halloween weekend and a Seahawks game this week, et cetera. A lot of people are spending a lot of time indoors, and that's going to change the numbers. We're also seeing nationally the emergence of a couple of new subvariants that are of concern. BA 4.6 is the big one, and then BA 1.1. The concern also is that we've seen cases rising in Europe. They're starting to rise in parts of the U.S. King County is actually doing better than most of the U.S. is at this point, which is good news, but it's also not sustainable as we enter the holiday travel season. Washington has expanded its vaccine eligibility to anybody age 5+. So that's good news. The bad news is that the latest booster, the bivalent booster that covers Omicron, less than 4% of Americans have gotten that vaccine booster. I'm one of them, by the way. And it was fine. You know, my arm was sore for about a day. That was it. So even more concerning is that more than half of Americans haven't even heard of the new vaccines. And that underscores that COVID has really disappeared from media coverage, especially as we get closer to midterms, Donald Trump going to jail, blah, blah, blah. We're not hearing about the vaccines, or at least many Americans are not. And that is a real concern from a public health standpoint. Somebody is not doing their job of messaging. And it does not help that you got everybody from President Biden on down saying, oh, the pandemic is over. It's not over. It has, morphed into something endemic where, it's going to be around and the goal is to suppress the spread. And that suppression is simply not happening, which is why the concern that as the weather cools, people move indoors and new subvariants come out, we may see a resurgence of the virus. So, yeah, the pandemic is not over. If you are in indoor spaces, especially ones that are not well ventilated or crowded, you should be wearing a mask, period, end of story. The other interesting pandemic news is that monkeypox cases have really been plummeting, and nobody's sure why. So that's something to keep an eye on. But it doesn't appear to be as alarming a virus spread as was initially feared. So that's the good news.
And people should be getting their flu shots right now because we're expecting a much bigger and much worse flu season this year.
Yeah.
All right. We're already over time, but why don't you talk about Nancy Pelosi?
Yeah, I will keep this under a minute, I promise. You know, people know what happened. And a home intruder in San Francisco tried to kidnap Pelosi's husband and then attacked him when it became apparent that Pelosi wasn't coming home anytime soon. This was an attempt by somebody on the far right with a documented social media history of spreading conspiracy theories and right-wing fever swamp lies to assassinate Nancy Pelosi, the third-ranking member of the federal government. And I'm, for all the media coverage of this, I am shocked that it hasn't been framed that way. You know, maybe people are afraid in the context of an election to go there, but that is what is at stake. This election is you have got one party that is answerable in terms of its base to people who are advocating violence and people who are advocating the overthrow of democracy. Period. End of story. And this unfortunate incident really underscores that, and it also underscores the media failure to put that in context. Corporate media, I mean. That's all I got to say.
Yeah, I think that really goes back to key members of the corporate world support the Republican Party, and we should be calling out those corporations and those individuals who do.
Yeah.
All right. That's all we got time for this week, but we'll be back next week.
I suspect there will be a lot more next week.
Yes.